refugee Anne Frank. So for those of us in the Jewish community, and for those of us who are not Jewish, but who simply care about never again repeating what happened to Anne Frank, when we look at the Muslim ban and we look at Syrian refugees, we say, let us save every future Anne Frank that we didn't save decades ago. And whether this kind of evil prejudice against refugees was perpetrated by a Democrat like Franklin Roosevelt or a Republican like Donald Trump, it is an unconscionable blot on the American national conscience. That's why, in the name of Anne Frank, we have an obligation to stand with Muslim refugees and to stand with all refugees to help them come into this nation.
A Texas mosque was just burned to the ground, Mark Potok, and the Jewish synagogue said, our building is big enough for both, and handed the keys over of their synagogue to the Muslims in the community. Your final comment. What do you think, Mark Potok, President Trump could do to show that he's serious about stopping these hate groups?
Well, I think he can't do much because the fact is that he is not serious about stopping them. The reality is he has stood by and said nothing, while not merely one, but three different mosques were burned to the ground in the month of January alone. That is the really remarkable thing. So I think that we are put in a position, we sort of the people of this country, of building intercommunal ties between Jews and Muslims and so on. And
we'll have to leave it there. Mark Potok and Stephen Goldstein, thanks so much for joining us. I'm Amy Goodman.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Underground Grad School. Classes that begin in March include Introduction to Music Theory, A Moment of Possibility, Finding Opportunity in Our Differences, Financial Freedom, Getting Empowered About Money in Your Life, and more. Portland Underground Grad School is also known as PUGS. Classes take place all over Portland metro area. Information about registering, teaching classes, and more can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214, unless otherwise noted. The Community Advisory Board meeting will take place Tuesday, February 28th at 5 p.m.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, accessories, and gifts with a focus on U.S.-made and certified fair trade natural fiber clothing since 1984. Gazelle is located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at gazellenaturalfiberclothing.com.
This is KBOO Portland.
Sisters have died. Over 500 years has washed away our fears and strengthened our pride. Now we turn back the tide. We will no longer hear your commands. We will slide your control from our lands. Redirect the flame of our anger and
And good morning. We're back once again. It's Wednesday morning, time for Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland. My name's Paul Rowan. Be with you till 9 o'clock. We are going to be talking about a very important subject that we haven't been talking about in recent weeks. The Dakota Access Pipeline. Today is the day for evacuating the camp. An eviction notice was given by the Army Corps of Engineers earlier this month after the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe itself had asked people to voluntarily leave the Osheti Sakwin camp there on the floodplains of the Missouri because of the danger of the when the thaws come, the ice dams break and possible flooding of that site, and they're feverishly cleaning up the site. We're going to be talking about all that in just a few minutes with my guest, Louis Grassrope, who is on the phone with us from a camp above the Osheti Sakwin camp where people some people have moved to already. I believe other people might be moving there. We'll talk about all that. And also Jacqueline Keeler, who's a regular co-host. Actually, it's not so regular because we keep changing the day of the month. But anyway, morning, Jackie.
Morning.
So we'll have Louis come up in just a second. I just have a couple quick announcements. There will actually be a No Dapple Eviction Day peaceful protest today at 2 p.m. There's a wide variety of views on exactly what's going down. Some people will be expressing their opinion in this manner at Pioneer Courthouse Square today at 2 p.m. Water protectors are surrounded by BIA militarized police and the National Guard. The eviction states that protesters will be forcibly removed from camps despite the fact that the camps are on private or treaty lands or both. Anyway, we will talk about all this. Also tomorrow, Bridge to Disaster, Resisting Fracked Gas in the Pacific Northwest, 7 to 9 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland at 1211 Southwest Main. The battle against fossil fuel infrastructure in the Pacific Northwest rages on in the face of last year's historic Clean Electricity and Coal Transition Act, which mandates the closing of all in-state coal plants by 2020. Portland General Electric is rolling out a plan to keep the Pacific Northwest locked into fossil fuel power for the next 30 plus years. Ignoring vast potentials for renewable energy, PGE is instead proposing to build two new gas-fired power plants as we phase out coal-generated power. If built, the Cardi Boardman Generation Station would be Oregon's new largest source of climate pollution. We want Oregon to be powered by clean, renewable energy, not dirty fossil fuels. And join the Climate Action Coalition, 350 PDX, the Sierra Club, Portland Rising Tide, Greenpeace, and Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility in building a popular campaign to resist the fossil fuel industry and to build a climate justice future. I'm reading that off of their Facebook page. That's tomorrow, 7 to 9 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland, 1211 Southwest Main. Those are a couple things going on. The song we heard to start out was Sing Our Own Song by Buffy St. Marie from her release of a couple of years ago, Power in the Blood, which I believe won some national awards. So here we are, and let me introduce Louis Grassrope. I actually don't know that much about you. I know that you ran for the Lower Brule. That's something on your cell phone. People have to just run with that. Last year, I know there's a hotly contested race and a situation maybe we'll get into a little bit at Lower Brule. But so good morning, Mr. Grassrope.
Morning.
Good morning, Louis.
Yeah, so tell us what's the feeling there? What's going on this moment? Has anything happened yet this morning?
Right now it's snowing out. The feelings are just the same as it's been the last week or so. I mean, we've been knowing and waiting for this time and everything that's been going on. So feelings are still high. You know, we're here to stop this pipeline and go forward in that manner. But it's been hard to do that when we're being oppressed by every government entity in this, that are standing against us right now.
So talk a little bit about the some of the various different perspectives or different approaches maybe that are going on. I know there's, you know, some people who want to just resist to the end at that camp. I know that there's been, you know, a general call out by the Standing Rock tribe for people to leave. Are there actual conflicts? Have people like been working these things out? What's going on there?
Well, I mean, I don't know when it, I can't remember the date when Standing Rock and Cannonball have asked the people to leave from the camps to go home. That was done maybe about a month ago, month and a half. And there hasn't been too much conflict. There's just been a lot of people that are very passionate about stopping this pipeline. They know the true significance of what the water means to everybody along the Missouri River. And the only conflicts that have really been is maybe talking and engaging with the governor of North Dakota to basically ask for extensions and ask for that they not come in a violent way. Mm-hmm. That's about the only thing I could really see.
The signal is, I'm not sure if people are really going to be able to hear. We can hear it because we have headphones on and it's coming directly over the phone line, but I'm not sure how we can possibly improve it. You're probably already at, you know, the best reception place you could find.
Actually, I mean, I got a good reception. I'm sorry, I'm sitting in my truck. I was putting my shoes on
there. Okay.
Fair enough. Well, so, if you can find a better place at all, I don't want you to be uncomfortable. So I know it's probably cold out there, but it would be really helpful so people can get, you know, it's really important what you have to say so people can hear the best.
Lewis, this is Jackie. I was wondering if you could describe the mood at the camp and what it looks like right now and sort of, I know that Chief Arville Looking Horse put out a request for prayers for today because of potential violence.
There's mood down at the camp is the same as anything as it always has been. It's some people are, I mean, they're very passionate people and they don't want to leave. They don't want to leave the area, and they're gonna stay. Mm. They've made it pretty vocal through live feed. That they're not leaving. So today we're faced upon to see what the actual state of North Dakota and the numerous law enforcement agencies that have came in here to assist in the removal of all the camps. Hmm.
So this includes the Ochati Shakoni camp, which is in the floodplain, and also even the Sacred Stone camp, which is above on a bluff, right?
It includes the Rosebud camp, the Sacred Stone camp, and the Ochati Shakoni camp. Mm-hmm.
So, and there's been a lot of removal, a lot of work done by the tribe and volunteers to clear particularly the area in the floodplain. And I know that they were doing, helping evacuate people yesterday with free bus tickets and assistance to get to Mandan and Bismarck.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was actually coming initiated by the tribe and the community there at Cannonball.
Yeah, it was. It was initiated by the Ochati Shakoni camp, and it was initiated by the Standing Rock. We're all still working in collaboration, you know. I mean, even though things may not seem that way through media and everything, but we're all still working hand in hand with each other.
Mm. And could you talk about the difference here? I mean, we talk about violence. We're not talking about violence from the people at the camp. We're talking about state violence. And the threat of that versus I think the versus the sort of approach from our people, from the Lakota Dakota people, of this as a ceremony, as a prayer.
So, I mean, the violence on the end of what we've been through the 6 months that I've been here has been, you could sit there. I know that the North Dakota would basically say that it's justified for their people to be to act in accordance of what they have been.
Mm-hmm.
But to violate many of our sacred items and many of our even our ceremonies. Destroying our homes, doing the things that they have done has been a very hurtful act beyond anything that we can speak of, because I know that if we did this and we went to a different Bismarck and started doing that to people's homes, we would definitely be handled in a violent manner.
I didn't introduce. I meant to mention that Jacqueline said that you're the traditional headman at
the headsman. One of the headsmen. Yeah.
At the Osheti Sakwin camp. Could you just explain a little bit for our listeners? I mean, I don't know how much people had a sense of the actual day to day. You know what it evolved. I was there in early December. Yes, and you know it was. All the veterans were coming. There was just so many supplies coming. It just, everything just seemed, there was a fair amount of chaos and just like kind of excess of everything going on. But what my impression was that there had been a sort of, it must have evolved a whole sort of organization of the camp in terms of the supply tents, in terms of the tools. But at that moment, everything was just kind of overwhelmed. And then I didn't really spend enough time to get a sense for how decisions were made. It was so big. It was like, it is almost like a, you know, kind of like a native friend of mine compared it, you know, to a standing army in a sense. I mean, you could make other comparisons, but you know, it had that feel to it. You had all these tents, you had all these different aspects, but it seemed like the organization of it was sort of just coming into being in a sense. Could you talk a little bit about the sort of the traditional decision-making structure and organization and other aspects of the camp?
Well, in the organization that you speak of is not an organization. It's something that the Great Sioux Nation, the bands of the Sioux Nation have never done in a long time, is that we actually put together, we put our teepees in the shape and the form of a buffalo, of a buffalo horn. So when we did that, it's the original traditional governance that we had at the time. So the ones that we were chosen to step up to be headsmen, as they say, are from the different bands, and basically all we are is representatives of our camps, and we make decisions with the people and with everyone that we can.
So there were like council meetings, regular council meetings.
Yeah, basically a lot of meetings between the headsmen and traditional people and, you know, everyone that was basically involved. It all started even when we first came here, when people actually put their foot on the first ground at the Osheti Sakwin camp. They had a council lodge up. There were many different nations that have come here over the, I can't remember the last count of how many nations were actually here, but a lot of representatives that have came from every nation were here. So, I mean, decisions that were made were based upon the, how the necessities of the camp and how are we gonna organize things so that
it wouldn't be so overwhelming. But with the many people that came in, especially on the December, with all the veterans that came in, it did get overwhelming because I think there was about 20,000 veterans that came here.
There was
2,000 people here. I mean, 2,000 veterans, but then there was like 20,000 people actually here on the ground.
Yeah, it was. Can you talk a bit about the way that this has been organized to represent all of the 7 council fires? That includes the 4 Dakota ones in to the east, and then the Ihanktawan and Ihanktawan and the Tetuan, the Lakota.
Can you explain that again?
Could you explain? I think that a lot of people don't realize that this is that Standing Rock represents not just the tribe itself, but because they're standing for treaty rights, it represent that all the different members of the Ochati Shakowi, you know, the Great Sioux Nation are involved on this, and that's what the headsmen are representative of.
Yeah, each teepee, there was the Ihanktawan, Sisatone, and then Wakpe Kute, Mede Wakatan, Wapitan, and then the Titawan, and then Ihanktawane. So you got the Ihanktawans were the basically like Yankton and area where they would, that would be where they're from, and the Sisseton's were the actual Sisseton Wapitan, and all three of the Wakwe Kute and Wapitan were all falling to the same thing with the Sisseton. Madi Wakatan is like a Shakopee and towards that direction
in Minnesota.
Yeah, and then the Titawans are all the tribes in South Dakota.
The Lakota, yeah.
All the Lakota tribes. And Ihanktawane is some of them are actually here in Standing Rock.
Yeah, they were. And in your own tribe, lower rural tribe, is it primarily Dakota, like the...
Lower Brew is based. We're Lakotas. And Crow Creek's right across the river, so they're the Dakotas.
They're the Dakotas. Okay, yeah.
So I guess one way I was going with that question about the structure of the camp, because the decision to close down, ceremonially close down the Oshetisakwin camp was done through the traditional leadership at the camp itself.
It was done into the, you know, everything that has happened for these past 6 months, or camp's been going on longer than that. But for us traditional leadership, or us representatives that have went to the council meeting, we heard what the people of Standing Rock, they voiced their concerns and their that they are, you know, I think everybody was getting tired of the fight and the economic decline that their casino has suffered
because of the blockade at the bridge.
Yep, because of the North Dakota purposely doing what they need to hurt their casino, which is their lifeline, and. When all the council made their decision, we agreed with it because in our way of life, we have to respect our relatives no matter what. That's the deal of being a good relative to each other. And we agreed with their decision because they asked us respectfully. And that was a decision that we all agreed upon at the time.
But obviously some people didn't agree with it because there's some people who are remaining there.
Well, a lot of people came, and I think most of us understood is that if we allow this pipeline to be built and goes underneath the water, it's not a deal of if it'll break, it'll be when. Exactly when. And North Dakota, Bismarck won't suffer. We with everybody that's going southward along that Missouri River will basically feel the total wrath of what this pipeline will bring, the destruction. And a lot of people are not leaving because they don't want to. We all came for the same thing, for the generations to come, to ensure that they have a better future and that they have sustainable, clean water that they could drink. Mm-hmm. But everything that, and that's the reason why most people will not leave this place. Mm-hmm. I don't disagree with them.
Yeah, that's, and what is the mood there now? I mean, I've been hearing, are there reports of like people burning teepees? Is that what, and that they are, that even the national park rangers have come in possibly, possibly armed. What is the, what do you see happening today at the camp?
That's a good question. In all reality, I think there was an agreement made. I don't know. I wasn't there at the time that they made that the agreement was made, that the people are going to make a treaty stance at that camp. Mm-hmm. But they are going to get arrested, as far as much as I know. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I mean, I can't sit here and quote unquote on that. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to say on what will happen. You got people that are very passionate about saving that water.
You talked about the trauma of the violence, of the state violence being done by North Dakota on Indian people and their allies. Do you think people are prepared for the trauma that might happen today? I mean, it's awful every time it happens, you know?
I don't think anybody's ever really ready for any trauma that comes up. I think it's they're not in preparation. I think they know that what might come today, and it's like you said, there's two. I don't know how many wildlife rangers or conservation officers or whatever they want to call them, state game and fish officers are here, but there's a mass amount of state officers here, state troopers. You got the BIA here. You also got the National Guard on the other side. You actually still got Martin County. Then you actually have NAPL security still.
So where are they actually in relation to the camp, all these law enforcement you're talking about?
Well, right now, I mean, I can't see down to the camp. Right now I'm up at the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribes camp. There's a blockade up here by the pit stop, which ain't too far from here, that's not allowing allowing people to come here to this camp, but they ain't allowing anybody to go any further. And then there's another roadblock right below this camp that they ain't allowing anybody to go down to those camps. I don't know where everybody's at, where all the law enforcement agencies are at this time. But there's quite a mass of people here that are here to fulfill what the following their orders to. Mm.
So the the blockade, the pit stop is right on Highway 1806, isn't it? The entrance to Cannonball, the community.
Yep.
And then if you go further into Cannonball, then you reach the river, the Missouri River. And I understand they're trying to prevent people from, they will only allow people to leave, and there's a blockade to the north. They're basically trying to prevent people from getting to the camp. What do you hope will, do you see a day when there might be, I mean, is it possible to have, what will happen to the tribes after this? I mean, you know, I know that, you know, speaking to a number of tribal leaders who are signees of the treaty, you know, they are concerned about abrogation of the treaty. Certainly anything having to do with the treaty, they feel needs to be a consensus decision. A strategy has to be done through consensus with all the signees of the treaty, including the Cheyenne and the Arapaho nations. Because if a person breaks the treaty, it's very hard to renegotiate it. And to break it on behalf of several nations without their consent, it seems like a very serious strategy to employ.
And that's true. I mean, that has to be on collaboration with every nation that is signed with the treaty. And it will be a hard thing to sit here and try to negotiate with the
Trump administration.
Yeah, with the Trump administration coming in, there's many things that are going to be coming towards every nation now. And I mean, that's the biggest worry that we need to worry about is privatization of our lands. I mean, they put us guys on these prison camps, as we call them, but they put us on these reservations. And they're finding out that there's minerals that they want out of them. And that comes down to the privatization so that they could get to them. Mm-hmm. And basically destroy our lands that they gave us, and that they put us on forcefully. And now that we're here, they see that there's oils and oil or whatever they need to, that they want. They want to come and take it from us, or take it from the land, which none of us really agree upon. Because we're not here to destroy the land. We're here to live in harmony with it.
Yeah, I think it's, I think that, you know, I interviewed a lot of people from Cannonball in the area this weekend, and tried to get their perspective, because I was a bit shocked that they actually really wanted to basically clear the Sacred Stone Camp, and I wanted to understand their perspective more. And when I was there in October, and I went to talk to some folk, I went to a community meeting, and I was really surprised. I had not expected them to say the things they said. They told me that they were traumatized by the violence that had been done in their name. They were traumatized when people were hurt in their name. They weren't sure they were ready for people to lose their lives in their name. And this is something that I think, a lot of people want to go out there and give everything, you know, for this. And it's a beautiful thing. And it's an incredible response and answer to what is a ceremony and is prayer, and from our relatives of all the nations. And it's a beautiful thing, but at the same time, it's a serious thing, you know? When I think of the violence that could happen today, and it's totally violence coming from this colonial state, this colonial nation, to protect its right, to basically through military force continue to exert its domination over our lands and our people and our allies even. I do, what can you do but pray? So.
And that's about all we can do right now. I mean, the whole fact is that you said everything that you needed to say. A lot of Standing Rock have called a lot of people here, and that decision, it bring a lot of people. And when we first came here, I don't think Standing Rock thought that this would be as big as it got.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a very universal and phenomenal thing that happened here, that it touched and awakened the world to stop corporations from doing what they're doing. And a lot of things that have happened during the time being here is, happened, I guess. You know, I mean, that's the only thing I could really say is that things needed to be done to hinder Dakota Access Pipeline from trying to get to the point where they are now. You have a lot of passionate people that came here, you know, to give their lives or do anything they can to try to save the water. I mean, save water and save the land as much as they can. Mm-hmm. Save all wildlife. I mean, all the creations that are in the path of this destruction once this pipeline breaks.
Mm-hmm. I just want to let people know that the voice you just heard is Lewis Grassrope from the Lower Brule tribe, who is been there, as he said, for 6 months. He's one of the headsmen at the Seven Council Fires traditional body that has been making decisions at the Oshetisakuin camp, which is under a threat of eviction as we speak. He is above the camp, can't see it, so he doesn't know exactly what's going on. The other voice you've been hearing is Jacqueline Keeler, my sometime co-host here on Wednesday Talk Radio. She herself is of Yankton, Dakota, and Navajo or Diné origins, and she's a writer and activist here in the Portland area. Started doing a lot of work on the mascots issue and writing about that and many other things. And she has been back there herself. This is a call-in show. We haven't invited your call-ins yet. We have about 25 minutes left. It's 503-231-8187 is the number to ask questions of my two guests. This is a very intense time. I'm sure you'll be hearing all over everywhere what is coming down possibly now as we speak and through the course of the day. We're sort of giving a both a general background and sort of what's going on, what's been leading up to today. And my name's Paul Rowan. I'm the host of the program. And so, yes, give us a call, 503-231-8187. Yeah, this whole, the thing that's, you know, we, again, so many, a difficulty of like understanding from afar, for one. Also, the, you know, it's difficulty for non-Native people to understand a lot about Native culture. There's a lot of complexities at the camp itself, as you've been hearing, and over the months, that it's something kind of unprecedented that nobody expected to happen that way. So people were kind of, as these things often are, sort of, you know, inventing things also as they go along in combination with traditional modes. So it's a very complicated situation. The thing that a lot of people are feeling is a lot of sense of disappointment, frustration, because a lot of people obviously put a lot of hopes on this thing, you know, that people have been fighting the fossil fuel pipelines, bomb oil trains, frack gas pipelines, export terminals here in the Pacific Northwest, around the country. People saw that as a place to kind of hold the line. And it seemed like a lot of, you know, things were happening that forced the Obama administration to make concessions. Things have changed now with the Trump administration. But I think, you know, a lot of people are feeling, you know, the need for this to continue to not just dissipate and go away. So that's the thing. How do you see moving forward, you know, as the part of the traditional Native leadership at the camp, as a member of one of the Osheti Sakuin, the Seven Council Fires tribes, as having been there on the ground for 6 months? How do you see this energy continuing and moving forward and not, you know, not just being, you know, we all face a lot of disappointments in facing this beast of the imperial machine.
As you can see from what has happened, the much awareness that has gone out from this place and the energy that came from this place, it's actually initiated camps all over the nation. There's already camps gone up in Florida, Texas, and other places where they're standing against pipelines, they're standing against mining, they're standing against everything that they see is an atrocious act towards Mother Earth and towards the people, and that's going to cause harmful acts against our people. So to keep this energy going is basically going back and teaching what we have learned here, and spreading it across the world so that they can sit there and go forward in the same manner that we have. You know, I mean, these are all learning lessons for all of us. So, you know, even though they're telling us to move the camps have not, people are moving to this camp and the fight's still going to continue.
And the camp you're at right now, Cheyenne River, is actually on land that the Cheyenne River Sioux tribe has leased, right, from the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. Yep, so it's a good place to go to if you know anyone out there looking for somewhere to go. And your own tribe, the Lower Brule tribe, is on the Missouri River downriver, and is also a signee of the Fort Laramie Treaty as well, isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah. So What is and you know, when I talk to my aunt Faith Spadigal, she always tells me that this is a ceremony, and that that these prayers have been carried forward. You know, she sees these prayers even coming from the ghost dances, like at Wounded Knee, and being carried forward to this time, and that the ceremony will continue to be carried forward all over the place. And I always take a lot of hope in that. And but I was wondering, what is the most, you've been there for several months and in all kinds of weather, and what has been the most memorable thing that's happened since you've been there?
Since the day I stepped a foot on this ground until now.
I guess, yeah, just sort of something that makes you stay, that gives you hope, that's something that you'll carry with you wherever you go.
Well, it's a, you got to understand is that most of us come from the oppression that we're underneath from our governments and everything that we're trying to do every time that we're catching the deal of the oppression here is like when we step forward or we stand up. People are telling us that you're bucking the system or you're standing against it, that you shouldn't do that. And this is the outcome. They will send everything to hinder you and stop you from doing it. So when we first took our first steps onto this ground, it was actual deal of hope, and it gave us freedom to live the way that we wanted to and to sit there and stand for a cause far greater than any of us so that we could sit there and make a better future for the generations, not just for the native people, but for all ethnicities that are in this pipeline. Now you got KXL starting up. You got everything that is going to destroy things and really make things into a vast wasteland. So, I mean, to us, this is hope beyond anything that we know. And it did. We got to live in freedom. We got to live our way of life. We got to sit there and cut wood. We didn't have to sit there and do all the stuff that we do. We're going to go back to the reality of our homes. We have to pay for rent and everything that we have to do. So we actually got to live free. Hmm. And we still are.
You can't, that's just amazing, because it's, you know, the ability to live in our traditional way in our camp circles, you know, which were broken up in the reservation years, where we were put on, you know, individual farms apart from each other. It's been an incredible experience, and I can't imagine that all of the people who have participated in that, even people who are not our relatives, but maybe are in some ways now our relatives through this experience, this will, I don't think it's ever going to end. I think it's going to continue to, you know, to trickle out to create new ideas about what's possible. And I don't, you know, I really pray that today will not have violence, obviously, and that people are not harmed or hurt, and that in some way this awful machine, this colonial machine, you know, will stop. We'll stop what it's doing, and but I really want to honor you and all the other people who have been there and doing this, and I know that the you know, the presence that you've been in the camp has been a really very positive one, and I think it's, you know, I'm glad that we've been able to share this with so many people.
Oh, mm-hmm.
So is there? Is this something you can talk about, the actual relighting of the Seven Council fire and the, you know, the bringing back of that sort of united Lakota Dakota leadership and unity? Is that something that you see carrying forward out of this?
Yeah, that's basically, it's going to be relit, but we don't know the time and date or when it's going to happen. We don't follow the calendars. We follow the stars, and when the stars tell us, we will be relighting that fire and reconvening at a different time and date. So the fire that was put out here will be relit again, and you know, all nations will be invited to come and keep this energy going, so that we could sit here and keep teaching the world that no matter where you come from, you're indigenous from somewhere. Mm. And I guarantee that your ancestors were actual caretakers and protectors of that land. And somewhere down the line, we all forgot. We all forgot who we were, because we were trained in this educational thinking of a corporate world and in the capitalism that we actually think of everything that we are in. It's time to awaken. I mean, that's the whole message. It's time to awaken, no matter if you're not native or not. This is not an indigenous or a native fight. This is a complete fight for every ethnicity out there, that they need to realize that who they are is actual people, what their actual role was when they were born into this world. You know, we keep forgetting about Mother Earth, because she's the one that gave you life. When you came out of your mom's, out of our mother's womb, that first breath that she gave you life. She wrapped your arms around you then to sit there and welcome you into this world. Mm-hmm. So everything that we got to sit there and remember is that it doesn't matter if you're from England or from Africa or anywhere, but the fact is that somewhere down the line, we were actually all caretakers, and we're supposed to take care of the land and protect the water and protect everything that we're supposed to. And a lot of people tend to forget about that, because we're so caught up into that one-track mind of thinking, where we're just worried about ourselves. We want to build a house and build a white picket fence, and that's it. We're good to go. But in reality, what have we actually done to try to prevent anything? Because if we're going to build a white picket fence in a house, how are our children supposed to live in a house if they can never sit there and drink water, or they can never do anything if this world keeps staying into the way it is?
So we do have a caller. I just want to, again, remind people, you're listening to Lewis Grassrope on the phone from North Dakota, from the Cheyenne River Tribe, above the Oshete Sakwin camp, where apparently law enforcement is amassing. We don't know what's actually going on at the camp itself, or the Rosebud or Sacred Stone camps, which are also under eviction. Also in the studio is Jacqueline Keeler, my regular co-host here. And we're talking about what's going on in North Dakota at the in the vicinity of the Standing Rock Sioux Nation, and the fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline. We do have a caller. Michael, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Hey, I want to thank you guys for having this show. I think it's wonderful to keep the real awareness news of what's going on in Dakota and elsewhere with indigenous people. Thanks again. And my question is, what can we do now still to help if we want to, you know, help, and we happen to live, like me, in Portland, Oregon? Is there, like, still donation possible, or are there any camps that are happening in Oregon that we can help focus on dealing with this fossil monster?
Any which way that you can donate, there's still a camp here, but there's camps going on, and I think there's one in Oregon. And keep spreading awareness. Send prayers. Keep things going on to divesting, defunding DAPL, defunding everything that's funding these corporations, these corporate giants, to sit there and keep doing what they're doing.
Yeah, I would agree that the defund DAPL movement is really gaining incredible traction. Just a couple earlier this week, there was a huge protest in Tokyo, Japan, where they're trying to get a bank there, which has like almost over $1 billion in investment in this pipeline to divest. And there are many cities that are doing this. Of course, Seattle did this already, Santa Monica, and Los Angeles is considering it, as is CalPERS, the public employee retirement fund in California, which has a lot of money. I was looking to divest from Wells Fargo and other banks that do business with DAPL. Another local group is the, I think they're called the Pacific Northwest Standing Rock Support Group. They're on Facebook. And I
think Pacific Northwest Stand with Standing Rock.
It says the Facebook group says Standing. And they are actually doing fundraising. They were doing fundraising last I heard to actually help people leave the camp and have sent a group out there to help with cleanup. There are really great legal fund groups like the Water Protectors Legal Fund, which has been providing pretty much all the direct legal support to water protectors on the ground. The tribe, of course, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, you can also donate to them. They have a big legal fight ahead as well in the courts, the federal district courts, over the consultation issue still. And of course, like Lewis said, there are different, many things going on around the country. Of course, there's the Pecos River pipeline fight that's going on in Texas. And of course, there are many fights coming up here in Oregon. With Warm Springs and Klamath. Oops, I think we just lost Lewis.
We lost somebody.
Okay.
Lewis, are you still with us?
Yeah. I'm
okay, good. That was the caller.
We lost our other caller. And of course, the Jordan Cove project in Coos Bay is going to be coming back on the table, if not already. And so I know that goes through Klamath territory. And so that'll be something to watch. And this... Of course, yeah, the Umatilla are heavily involved in this issue out in Boardman. If a pipeline rears its ugly head to feed that monster, a natural gas monster, again, that's tomorrow to find out more about that. Bridge to Disaster, Resisting Frack Gas in the Northwest at the First
Please
Unitarian...
hang up and try your call again.
First Unitarian Church in Portland at 1211 Southwest Main. That's tomorrow evening, 7 to 9 p.m., to talk about the proposed gas plant at out at the Cardi Boardman plant out in eastern Oregon. So that's an important place. So are you still with us, Lewis? Oh, we did finally lose him. And I didn't give you the number to call him back. Should we get him back, or do you want to just... continue the show.
Let me see. Did I have?
Sorry. Well, I've got his number. Okay. Well, go ahead and talk more about the how to carry this on in Oregon.
Okay. Yeah. I thought maybe I would talk a little bit about. I talked to a number of people at Cannonball this weekend to try to understand the community's perspective. Many people are confused and don't understand why the local community of Cannonball has actually. Voted and asked for the camps to be cleared. And I think that it was very confusing to me too. And so I decided to talk to many people there. And you know, there is the whole issue of these are very poor communities. I think the individual income per person on the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation is $4,421 per year. There's about 8,000 people on the reservation that live on the reservation.
I thought they were all rich because of the casino.
And the casino has taken a hit. It went from making $16 million to making $14 million to making $8 million. So it's a $6 million loss. And so this roadblockade is an active economic burden on the community. And also it's aggressive basically economic sanction against the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe by the state of North Dakota. And the tribe is not rich. That $6 million goes not only to pay the debt on the casino, but also to pay for many social services for the community, which in a community as poor as this are absolutely necessary. It can mean the difference between life and death. People, even this winter on the reservation, died because they didn't have propane. They froze to death. People don't have money to drive places to put gas in their tank, or many have to go to Bismarck to work to have a job. So these seem like pedestrian concerns to many people. They're not idealistic, maybe, but they are necessary to people. And so I think listening to the community, listening to their concerns, I think is essential. My background... I was trained as a community organizer. I worked in several Native communities in the Southwest. And And yeah, I mean, you to be a successful organizer, I think you do have to listen to the community and to hear their concerns.
And there's some concern that part of the problems that came about, and again, this is something we can't deal with in the last 5 minutes of the show, but that had to do with what you're saying, that there was, you know, just so many different points of view, and probably stubbornness and ideologies and egos and everything else. But some of the problems could have been avoided, as I think you've said, if people had, from the beginning, like worked more directly with the local communities of Cannonball.
Yeah, I think that I'm writing an article about this now, but basically I feel that when people go into a Native community and they find a couple of really nice, charismatic spokespeople, those spokespeople often, you know, many times, like many people do, only speak for themselves. And I think that's a good start to organizing, but I think you have to incorporate the entire community. And everyone I spoke to in Cannonball is against the pipeline. They do not support the pipeline. What they want, they have certain needs they have as a community. And there were other aspects too of it, which some of they were having issues with some of the people who remained, who were, not well mentally, and it's a great burden on a community with very few resources.
And there must be, you know, it's probably a difficult subject to get into, especially.
Yeah, I'm probably not going to say more than that.
There's just, where people are people, you know, so if people, as you say, in these difficult economic conditions, see all these donations coming in, this whole flourishing camp, I can only imagine it's natural that there's the range of human emotions and feelings about that can come into play.
Yeah, people in Cannonball said they didn't actually have access to Sacred Stone. They weren't allowed to go there. The camp was very secured against outsiders. And so, and then that it was turning into its own sort of town meant that it had to have jurisdiction by the district, which is Cannonball. And the tribal council decided they would accede to the district's decisions because it was in their area. And there's an issue about the land ownership. From the documents I could see, you know, the tribe is the majority owner of that land. And so definitely the district has jurisdiction.
So we only a few minutes left, and Lewis is back with us. So you probably heard a little bit about what we were just saying. And again, I apologize to bring up big issues at the end. You don't have to deal with any of that. But just to give us, I don't know if you've heard anything since about what's going on, or if you have any other final words to our audience here in the Portland area and beyond.
I just caught into a little bit what you guys are talking about. But, the best thing right now is to sit here and, as I said, is to keep the awareness going and pray for a better outcome of what may happen today, but we don't know. It's all whatever is going to happen at 2:00.
And of course, there'll probably be legal support, possibly legal support and other support needed as a result of anything that might happen today as well.
Yes.
And the Medics and Healers Council, I should have mentioned them as well. They're doing great work out there.
And I will put links to these various things on my website, which I didn't do before the program, but that's kboo.fm/Wednesday Talk Radio. And we just have a couple minutes left. Thank you so much, Lewis. We really appreciate your coming on and stand strong. And are you going to be staying on there for a while longer?
Staying here at the camp?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll be here.
Okay.
Awesome, yeah. Well, yeah, thank you, Lewis. And I just wanted to wish you luck today, and I definitely enjoyed interviewing you while I was there in December, and I really took a lot of hope from your words and your perspective on what this means in the long run for our people and for the next generation.
Okay, well, we are just about out of time. I'll just mention once again that people will be gathering at Pioneer Square, Courthouse Square here in Portland at 2:00, a No Dapple Eviction Day peaceful protest, 2 p.m. Today. And tomorrow, again, continue the fight against fossil fuels here in the Northwest. Bridge to Disaster, resisting frack gas in the Northwest, 7 to 9 p.m. at First Unitarian Church in Portland, 1211 Southwest Main. And we are just about out of time. Thank you, Jacqueline. We'll have you again, I'm sure, on before too long.
Definitely.
And we'll keep in touch with what you're doing. And so thank you, people, for listening. We only had one caller today, but I'm sure people were wanting to hear the words directly from Standing Rock about what's going on. And thanks to Lewis Grassrope for being on our program as well. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of Stand Together, a day of action workshop Saturday, February 25th, 9:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Stand Together is a day of workshops for people new to social and political action and for those upgrading their skills. Sessions include digital security, photography for action, strategic planning, nonviolent direct action, legal basics, know your rights, and more. Again, that's Stand Together, a day of action workshop, Saturday, February 25th, 9:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. at the First Unitary Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue,